We just want to do a disclaimer before we start the episode. Things discussed here can be graphic, traumatic, or potentially triggering to individuals. So keep in mind who is listening and be mindful of how it will affect them. This is Life on Duty, a podcast giving firsthand accounts from the first responders regarding scenarios that have affected them emotionally or mentally and how they've dealt with it.
Hey guys, this is another episode of Life on Duty, and this is Dobby with Oz, who is actually behind a black curtain right now that he created so that Amos, our guest today, will not be distracted by his movement. Amos, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Okay, well, I was born and raised in a small town, going back in my younger years. I was actually born with a cleft lip and palate, so most of my summers, all the way up until I was a senior in high school, was spent at Children's Hospital doing numerous surgeries, stuff like that. But, you know, I still raised up pretty good. When I started my senior year in high school, it was actually right before Christmas break. I had joined the fire department for volunteer, nothing crazy. I thought it was cool. I had a buddy in high school that he always wore a shirt to high school, and I was like, oh, this is awesome. I ended up joining. I did that for probably about 8 years, 7 or 8 years, volunteer. And I decided to be a grown-up and go get my EMT and my fire warden, too. After that, me and my wife bought a house in a different city. I changed apartments a little bit. I served there for 2 years. I actually ended up getting my first career job at another neighboring city. And I was there for 2 years.
So how long have you been working on the ambulance?
As soon as I got my EMT, I got on the ambulance part-time because I was doing other jobs and I didn't have time for it. So I just did it part-time for about 7 years. And I just recently went full-time about 2 years ago. And now I'm in med school.
Right. So Amos has a story that he's wanting to share with us today. And if you'll just start the story however you want, Amos, the show is yours.
Sure. So whenever I went career on my career department there, it's a very small department, very small city. So there wasn't a lot of manpower there. You know, like I said, two guys on a truck most of the time, or all the time. There wasn't a whole lot of stuff going on, I guess. As far as training, leadership was kind of poor. So it was kind of like a self-run department, I guess. So I was on the job probably about 6 months or so.
Whenever you started a career, how long have you been a volunteer up to this point?
It was about 8 or 9 years.
Okay.
Volunteer. And then I was actually a CEO at a prison, a local prison. It was kind of during COVID. I had put in an application for this department. They actually quit looking at applications because of COVID. Whenever I started the prison, they had called me like 2 weeks later, said, hey, we want to hire you. I'm like, okay, cool. Most departments, when you do an interview process, it's usually suit, tie, you know, look nice, whole interview board, stuff like that. I walked in there in my blue jeans and a t-shirt and got the job. So that's how little this department is.
No, you say in a couple of months into the job?
Yeah, about 6 months into the job. So on this part, we were at 48-hour shifts. It was starting our second day on. It was about 2 o'clock in the morning. I'm dead asleep, sleeping real good, and we get paged out for a first alarm fire. We have an overhead radio, but at night they turn it off. So all we had was our little pager, little box pager from like 1970. So we get paged out for this fire. They say all the radio traffic comes out of the first alarm with entrapment. So immediately I get up, get dressed. I go into this mode of like tunnel vision / pre-planned, trying to figure out, you know, what's going on. It's just me and another captain. That's it. The first alarm is at a neighboring city, but that neighboring city is like 3 minutes away. So this fire was right up the road. We get all our stuff going on, get in the truck. Me and my captain is kind of talking back and forth, like, what are we going to do? What's going on if we get there? So we take our ladder truck, because that's what's on their alarm assignment. And an alarm assignment is just a basically a thing for dispatch to correct truck. Each department has an assignment of whatever truck they want. So we take the ladder truck. We get on our way. We get up there to the house. And I can see it as soon as we pull on the street. This house is rocking. And also, the neighboring city, they're kind of like us. They only run two guys on the truck. So I see a heavy fire load. Not sure if there's entrapment in it or not. I go down. It's kind of this yard's like in an embankment. And I hear a guy yell at me on the other department saying, "Hey, hose line's already stretched out. My guy's down there. Get with him." Cool. So I get down there, and this guy is a junior fireman. Still in high school, like no training, nothing.
So he's a teenager.
Exactly. Yeah. 17, 18 years old. I go into this mode of, I'm by myself. So I tell him, I said, "Hey, get behind me." I said, "We're going to go to the front door. We're going to knock some of the fire out and see what's going on." So as we're going to the front door, we get radio confirmation that there is entrapment. So a lot of fire load, and I'm looking around, and I can see a stairwell. They said that these people were in the top floor of the second story house. So I'm thinking, okay, knock this fire out, go up the stairwell, and get the people out. That is my pre-plan. Also, dealing with tunnel vision, a lot of emotions at one time. And also, got to keep this guy behind me alive, because he's 17, 18 years old. We get probably 4 or 5 feet inside this house, still a heavy fire load. The only way to these people, the stairwell collapses. It just tumbles down. So,
right in front of you?
Right in front of me, yes. Right in front of me, the stairwell collapses. Fire had been burning for a hot minute. It was an older house. So we back out. Because when something collapses, you know, it just kind of, it makes a big ruckus. You know, fire pushes out, everything else. When we go to the left side of the house. So if you're not familiar with fire terms, the front of the house is called Alpha Side. And you go clockwise, you have Bravo, Charlie, Delta side. So we were actually going to the Bravo side. And as we make our way over there, it's kind of like a half deck. Kind of weird. It's like the deck's kind of like on a concrete pad, then it goes off of a regular deck. So we step onto that, and I realize there's like a screen door on that Bravo wall. We make our way to there. I happen to look back into the back of the yard, and I see a guy like laying on the ground. And I'm thinking, oh my God, what is that? So I make my way back there, and I realize that this guy has jumped out of the window of the second story. I holler at him. I said, hey, you all right? And he's like, yeah, fine. Well, he points towards the house. I was able to look around the house enough to the Charlie side. I looked up into the window and realized there's a woman hanging out of the window.
When you say hanging, what's that mean?
She was hanging out from the waist. The waist up was hanging out of the window. The rest of her was still in the house. Not sure if she's alive or dead. By this time, there's other departments arriving. So another department came around, and I guess they had threw a ladder up there. She's dead. She's gone. She died. Probably because of the heat and smoke inhalation. So we kind of focus our care onto that guy that jumped out the window. It was his girlfriend. He's like, I jumped out of the window. You know, I told her, I was like, let's just jump. Let's go. Let's get out of here. When I jumped out of the window, I hit the AC unit in the window below. So this guy jumped. He hit the AC unit and then fell out to the yard. And then he crawled about 5-10 feet just to get away from the house. As we're talking to this guy, it's like, hey, anybody else inside the house? And he's like, yeah, there's 4 other people inside the house up in the second story.
Not counting her?
Yeah, not counting her. It was a grandpa, a grandma, his daughter, and a granddaughter. And then he jumped out. We immediately go into scrambling mode, like, we gotta get up there. We gotta figure something out. The fire hadn't really made it up to the second story yet, but there was a lot of heavy smoke. Smoke was just barreling out of this house. By this time, we had plenty of help. I thought we had plenty of help. I'm in this mode of, I don't know what's going on around me. I don't know who's around me. I'm just trying to figure crap out. So we get back on the hose line and we fight fire. It seemed like it fought fire for 4.5 hours. It was only like an hour. We kept trying to make our way into this house to get up the stairs subway. Ladders all around the house. By this point, I think it's more of a recovery than it is a rescue, which, unfortunately. So, yeah, that was pretty much the gist of what went down in about 10 minutes. After relief got there, you know, after an hour or so, we switch out. Making my way up this hill, I remember taking my helmet off, and I threw it at the ground because I was so mad. I was filled with anger because I couldn't do anything. The stairwell collapsed. There's no way inside this house. All these people are upstairs. So I'm at a loss right now. I'm angry. I'm mad.
Well, and there's only two of you trying to save everybody.
Right.
Sounds like.
I'm trying to deal with my emotions on the call, but still trying to be professional. Because by this time, everybody on that street is watching us. Family is there, and they're all running around screaming, like, why aren't you doing anything? Like, what's going on? I mean, what do you tell them? You know, like, hey, sorry, you know, your family's dead. That was a hard moment whenever family showed up.
How long was it before they got informed? Did somebody inform them right away, or was it like they figured it out on their own?
Yeah, so I'm not really sure. I'm assuming the neighbor must have, because the neighbor was pretty emotional when we first got there. She was frantic, running around. So I'm assuming she probably got in contact with the family. But I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, I'm watching this unfold even more from behind the scenes or whatever. They're over here giving us water, stuff like that, and I don't even want to drink anything. I don't want to talk. I don't want to eat. I don't want to drink. Don't even check my vitals. Like, don't touch me. Because I'm just so distraught. All that happened, and we go back to work on this fire. About 4 hours is what it took to get the fire under control. So now it comes to, we got to get these people out. Can't just leave them up there. That was the hard part, was taking these dead bodies out of the house, and Corner was on his way. It was taking a ladder and basically cutting a hole up into the second story and getting a stoats basket, putting one body at a time in this stoats basket and taking him down.
Like, not in a body bag, just straight out.
Straight out. Once we took him out, took him to the backyard, laid him on a tarp till the Corner got there, covered with the sheet. It was really hard because I felt like it was very unprofessional, the way it was done. But our resources were kind of, I guess, limited as far as, like, body bags, stuff like that. We didn't carry body bags. We didn't have none of that. That was, like, I guess the only option was a tarp and a wait till the Corner got there. As time went on, you know, this fire went to a fourth alarm fire. Everybody in that county was there. 16, 17 departments.
What is a fourth alarm?
So a fourth alarm is, anytime there's a house fire, you start out with a first alarm. Once you get on scene, you can strike a second, third, fourth alarm. That just means that you have more trucks coming. Each alarm assignment is different. One may have more pumpers on it. One may have more tankers. Whatever the manpower you need, basically, on that alarm assignment. So a fourth alarm is, everybody in the county is there. We need a lot of help. It took about 4 hours to get this fire under control.
At that point, you guys wait for the Coroner to arrive. Like, I guess you were still there whenever he did arrive. And then he goes through his whole process.
Yeah, when he got there, it was a big job for him, just as it was for us. Just because by this time, you have every local news channel there. So it was a big deal. So for him to, by himself, come into this scene and get these bodies, he was emotional wreck himself. I mean, he's just talking to him, you can tell that he was like, oh my God, like, what just happened? What's going on? So it was just as stressful for him as it was for us. The thing that I think bothered me the most was, and nothing against the news channels, but it seemed like they had no, like, a lack of respect, I guess, for what was going on. They just came in there full throttle, set their stuff up, and I mean, we just had four fatalities. One just jumped out of the window. Now the news camera's in your face and all around, and that was pretty stressful in itself. on top of what just happened and what went down.
What was the atmosphere of the scene and, like, the scene management? Like you said, there was quite a few people showing up. So, like, how chaotic was that? Did the police have everything under control?
Yeah. So, when we first got there, the police were, they were there. As time went on, the police stepped out of the way. By the end of it all, we had numerous commands set up, different officers doing different stuff. One for rehab. We have a chaplain running around trying to talk to people and settle emotions and stuff like that. So there were numerous resources for the call, like on the scene. You have a big incident command set up. Every little thing goes through incident command that gets done. So all your Bravo section, all your sections go through command, your water supply, everything goes through incident command. So it was very organized, that's for sure. Very well set up.
What was the aftermath like for you?
After the whole getting the bodies out of the house and everybody there helped the coroner get his stuff done because we wanted them out of there where nobody could see them. Just respect, you know. But after all that said and done and, you know, we're cleaning it up, I think that's when the emotions started to flow. A lot of people start asking, hey, are you okay? Are you need anything? Departments are starting to leave. I feel like the departments that came from pretty far away weren't as emotional of what my department was. It wasn't as hard for them as it was for us. So they just got their stuff and left. It was just another job for them. But as they were leaving, people started asking, hey, you guys good? So that was kind of refreshing, but kind of not, because it really didn't help anybody.
So after you left there, how long, or does the call still affect you in some shape, way, or form?
Yeah, so after everything was said and done, we go back to the firehouse. And of course, I didn't expect a whole bunch of people to be at the firehouse. We are volunteers and staff, but there were numerous people there. And there was a lot of emotions at the firehouse. A lot of tears were shed, a lot of cussing back and forth. But it was good cussing. It was emotional cussing, I guess you could say. There wasn't a whole lot of support after the fact. Like, initially there was, but that was the only support that we got, was right there after that call.
Oh, just them asking?
There was no, after 2 or 3 hours of the call, there was no support there. And I feel like that affected a lot of people, not having that future support. There was one guy that had asked me, if you need to talk, just let me know. He's like, come over, we'll have a beer, and we'll talk things out. I had a lot of respect for this guy, because he said that to me. And then there's another guy. All he said was, you need to hug your kids a little tighter. And what really, really made me mad was he was a leader of the department. And I figured he would have more initiative to, you know, hey, this guy is hurting. Like, we need to talk to him and, you know, make sure he's okay. For him to say just that, it struck me wrong. It hit me hard. And I was like, this guy is not good. There was no release of what just happened after about 2 or 3 hours after that call.
So what I'm hearing is that you felt like the people who reached out to you were more just like as a human reaching out to you, like, hey, are you doing okay?
Yeah, and then, it was more of a brother to brother mm-hmm. kind of thing.
And then afterwards, it sounds like you want what was, I think it's known as a hot debriefing, where it's like a brief go over of the call to try to figure out a hot debriefing, where it's a quick go over of the call and it's able to give you like a little review rapidly, but not fully in depth. When you went on with it, did you have any kinds of signs and symptoms that concerned you, or that you were you with your wife at that time?
So yeah, me and my wife were married. That's actually something that we had just recently talked about. My wife said, because I asked her, I said, how did it affect me? because I was so distraught. I said, how did I act? And she said, you were mostly just quiet. I feel like I shut down a lot of things. I really shut down a lot of stuff in that department. I quit caring as much. That really affected me. As far as like fires and stuff, I just didn't give my 110% like I always have. You know, being on the volunteer department all them years, like I was the one that gave 200% all the time. And after that call, it just, like, my drive was gone for the fire service. And it really, really affected me.
Would you say that you were numb?
I would say so. You were talking about the post-talk or whatever. We never had that. There was no talk after that fire. Just what happened at the firehouse, that was our talk. Like, there was no release for us that were on that call. I took that call. I sunk it down in my belly, and I let it go. I didn't talk about it again. I didn't think about it again. Actually, the other day, me and my wife were at the house, and she was just asking me, like, hey, what are you going to say on this podcast and stuff? And I told her, I was like, well, I really don't know. I was like, I'm going to wing it. We were kind of going through it and stuff, and we're sitting there in the kitchen making dinner, and I started talking about this call, and I just started crying. Like, tears rolled down my face, started shaking, and I'm like, what's going on? Like, why am I doing this? I haven't looked at it since that day. Like, I never searched it on the internet. I never talked to anybody about it. When I talked to my wife 2 weeks ago, that was the first time I talked about it in 2 years. I felt like it really released something. I don't know if it was stress that was built up from that call. Like right now, I can talk about it. I feel okay to talk about it. It's not affecting me like it did 2 weeks ago. I know it's weird to say, but yeah, I guess just talking to my wife about it just made it better.
So you didn't even speak to your wife about it? Is that what you said initially?
So I called my wife at the firehouse after we had our little powwow or whatever. I called her and I told her just real briefly about it. I didn't paint a big picture for her. And I just told her, I said, hey, you know, we had a big fatality fire. I'm okay. And that was basically it. So there was no in detail.
So isolation, numbness. I think I heard that you were angry at the department that was involved. Did you find that you were blaming them, someone else, or yourself for the circumstances?
On the call, I blamed myself. I blamed myself a lot. Because I felt like when I was there, I felt like I should have been the leader. I was the leader. I was the only one down there at the time. So I felt when all that went down and I wasn't able to do anything, I put all that on my shoulders. I took full responsibility for it, which I shouldn't have, because it wasn't my fault the stairwell collapsed. It wasn't. I took the stress of that call and put it on my shoulders, and I blamed myself for everything that happened.
But you don't do that anymore. You don't feel that way, or do you still struggle with that?
No, I think after that call, I've learned a lot of coping mechanisms, ways to deal with things better than the way I dealt with that.
So with your wife being a first responder, paramedic herself, you said you found a relief in even talking to her. And would you say that it bettered your personal relationship between each other as well? Or is it just, you just realize she's there for you and you can share with her?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like we have a good relationship no matter what. I don't think it made the relationship any stronger. Mm-hmm. She already understands me and kind of understands what I went through on that call. But talking to a fellow first responder and looking at her, not as a wife, but as a coworker, I think she understood it more than what somebody else would, such as like a counselor, whatever it may be.
Someone who's on the job.
Right. Somebody that understands what goes on, what happened. And
what about your kid? You had kids at the time, right?
I did.
So yeah. How did that affect you and their relationship, or do you even know?
So, I felt like when it first happened, I made sure our house was super safe. I was going through, checking smoke detectors, we went over pre-planning of the house. Like, if the house ever catches on fire, where do you guys go? Like, we had a meeting point, which I should have done that years ago, but I just never, you know, I don't think about that stuff. I didn't think about it. After that call, I thought about it, and it hit hard.
Right.
So we had a pre-plan. They knew where to go. All the smoke detectors were working.
Would you say that you were overly reactive, like what is known as hypervigilance, so that you're like over the top, like yeah. making sure that everybody's like super safe?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, I made sure their doors were shut every night, because in a house fire, with the door shut, you have more time to
figure things out.
The fire's not going to go in that room as quick. I made sure all fire safety for our house was good. There were going to be no hiccups or no entrapment.
So what all do you think could have been done better? The debriefing overall, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Is there anything else that you think that the department could have done to better help you and its other employees?
I definitely feel like the post-debriefing, I feel like they definitely needed that. I feel like it would have been very beneficial for a lot of them, including me. But as far as the department, like they had no support system for anything like this at all, because they never dealt with it. I mean, this department ran 600-700 calls a year, so they never dealt with anything like that. They just never had anything set up.
So now you're an EMS. Did that call have an impact on you leaving the fire service?
I would say most definitely. I haven't been on a pumper or any kind of fire engine in the past 2 years. I have no drive to do it. Sometimes I wake up in the morning and I think I'm going to I'm going to go back volunteer. I'm going to do this. And then I think about it and I'm like, it's not even worth it. Like, I don't want to do this. When I first started, back when I was a senior in high school, I used to eat, sleep, and breathe fire. Like, that was my thing. I loved the way it worked. I liked the way that the atmosphere was. But after that call, it just something clicked in my head that I just don't want to do it anymore. And I find that EMS is more, it's different. It's more it's geared different than what the fire department is and the fire service.
And you think it just fits you better now?
Right. Yeah. I feel like working EMS, I get more pride out of doing EMS than I do fire, just because of the patients that I get to meet and I get to help all my coworkers. The support system where I work now is amazing. Anything that happens, I'm getting a text in 30 minutes to an hour. Hey, are you good? From multiple people. Even after the call, while still on the scene, we're already talking about it. We're already debriefing. And where I work now, the support system is amazing. It's great.
What did you do personally to get through the process?
So whenever I was still, I guess, after that call, I was still in the department for about a year and a half. During that year and a half, I felt like I picked up some, I guess, kind of bad habits. I started drinking. That was a pretty big thing. And it wasn't like going to the bar, getting flat drunk and passing out. It was more of I'm at home, I'm drinking beer, and I'm drinking enough to where I don't feel anything. And it wasn't like I wasn't by myself. I wasn't suicidal. But there was something inside of me that I needed to get out. And I felt that alcohol numbed that pain.
So literally using it as a coping mechanism to work through it. And you were unaware of what it was you felt like? Was it just like a monster lurking in the dark?
I think after some time, I think realizing that drinking wasn't healthy for me, there was a lot of anger with that. Not with the alcohol, but just in general after that call. I felt irritable. I felt angry all the time. I felt like I couldn't do anything right. Every little thing that my kids or my wife would do, I snap on them or something, just out of the blue. So I feel like putting that with alcohol made me realize that alcohol is not the answer. But I still think when I quit drinking, I feel like that it was still buried inside of me that I just didn't deal with it. That was the issue. I didn't deal with it.
Did you feel like you just weren't equipped to?
Yeah. Well, I mean, as time went on, people just forgot about it. And I never forgot about it. I mean, there's still times today where I think about it. And I think about things I could have done different or things that could have went different. But it doesn't affect me like it did at the very beginning of this.
Would you say that there was an event when you were drinking that you were like, this is enough, or your wife was like, this has got to stop?
Yeah, so when I used to drink, I would drink whenever I was doing something, like working on the house, grilling. I would always tell myself, oh, I'll just have a beer or two. And that beer or two would turn into 10 or 12 beers or even more. I wouldn't know when to stop drinking. And I think that's what was killing the pain, was not stopping.
When you were drinking, you said earlier that it like was a numb thing. When you were drinking, when you would first start, were you like, this is going to make it better?
When I first started, I didn't think anything about it. I didn't think, oh, this alcohol is going to kill the pain. Just looking back at it now, because I didn't drink before this happened. And I feel like looking back at it now, that's what killed most of the pain. And maybe it just made me numb, but I didn't feel it.
How would you say it affects you now?
I feel like now it makes me sad to think about it. Just because I feel like it could have had a different outcome if I had more manpower or just more resources. When I think about it for a while, just like a few hours. Just thinking how it could have been different.
So I feel like just a few things should be addressed. I think it's important is that earlier in the episodes, I can't recall which one it was exactly. We spoke about second victims for a little bit. You can not only connect yourself, but when something on a scene or with a patient has an adverse effect so that it's affected in a negative manner, you can find yourself in the situation that Amos is in, which is questioning whether I made the right choices or not. You also can hear there's a lot of telltale signs of PTSD within Amos's story. Anger, helplessness, hopelessness, the loss of motivation to even be a part of that career field, the way that he treats his family. Amos and I worked together for probably, 6 months, I think, as partners full time.
Yeah.
And he's just not somebody you would expect to admit to being a snappy or angry individual. He's a guy who's pretty uplifting almost all the time. So to hear him talk about that stuff is pretty significant because of how it affects him. Do you have anything that you would like to tell the listeners? Advice, words of wisdom, maybe someone who hasn't experienced what you're going to go through?
I would say don't hold stuff in. Don't bury it down inside like I did. Get with somebody, whether it's a peer or a counselor or a wife, husband, whatever it may be. Talk to that person and let them know what's going on. I feel like when you bury stuff down inside, that at least to what happened to me, started drinking, or more things, you know, suicide, whatever it may be, don't hold it inside. Have a good support system. If you're somewhere where they don't have a debriefing, if I would have been more proactive, I should have done it myself. I should have set up a debrief or something within a department to help everybody else. Even if it wasn't, you know, official or whatever, just something to get everybody on the same page with this and be like, you're not alone. This is affecting several people. Just a time where everybody could share their feelings and talk it out. That's what I would say is the biggest thing. It's just don't hold it in. Like, let it out. Talk to somebody. You're not alone in this situation.
How long ago was it? 2 years?
Yes. Yep.
So I just want everybody to realize that he's a young man who has a good personal life, and things caught up to him immediately after the call, and then it continued slowly over 2 years for him to work through the process and having to struggle with it personally. So That's the importance that Life on Duty recognizes, the need for peer support and counselors who are specializing in first responders so that we can find a way to bridge the gap. We're hoping that our organization will reach a point soon where we can be able to do CISD, critical incident stress debriefings, and stress management for individuals and groups because of this reason, so that Amos's life could have been easier sooner, possibly, or at least he knows there's somebody in it with him. Amos, we just want to thank you for coming out and sharing your story with us. It really means a lot to us, and that does not sound like an easy scenario, and I'm sorry that you had to go through that.
Yeah, I really appreciate you guys letting me come on the show. I think it's awesome what you guys are doing. I hope it takes off and you're able to help millions of people. Because I used to work in a psych facility, and I understand that mental health is not something to take lightly. So what you guys are doing here is amazing. I really do hope you guys help several people. It'd be awesome.
Well, thanks, buddy.
Millions to seven people.
Thanks for listening to Life on Duty. If you're interested in sharing a personal story you have and how it affected you, please email us at lifeondutypodcast@gmail.com. If you like the shit we discuss and want to hear more, follow us and give us something better than a one-star rating. If you believe in what's unfolding here, check us out on Patreon, patreon.com/lifeonduty, or use the link in the show notes below.